Good afternoon. I'm Clayton Miller, and I have the privilege of conducting this service this afternoon, a service that we are doing in memory of Jeffrey Spanner. I did not know him, except that I've spent 2 hours just this morning with the family in a very intimate sharing and reminiscing, and I feel as though I know him. And I always appreciate the fact that at a service like this, members of the family and friends are going to talk about the deceased, those who really do know him. So I'm here to bring a presence of God into our time together. Let us pray. Almighty and most gracious God, thou who art the source of all that is, we give you thanks for the life of Jeffrey Spanner. And as we remember him today, may our thoughts be appropriate expression of our gratitude for his life among us. May none of our feelings be inappropriate, the feelings of disappointment and sorrow, the feelings of joy, even the feelings of guilt. I ask that we may not have the feeling of fear, that we may be people of hope and faith, and that you will relieve us from any sense of fear, but rather may the best of our feelings and the best of our memories be as acts of worship offered to you by our thoughts and our meditation. Amen. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted and saved the crushed in spirit. The Lord heals the brokenhearted and binds their wounds. Great is our Lord and abundant in power, whose understanding is beyond our measure. The Lord is my helper. The Lord is my ever-present help in times of need. The Lord is the light of my life. Let not your hearts be troubled, neither let them be afraid. I want to read probably one of the most familiar pieces of literature in all the world. It's been used for literally thousands of years on occasions like this, and I think of the millions of people that these words will have brought comfort to. I hope they bring comfort to you, the 23rd Psalm. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil, my cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. As I was thinking about an appropriate scripture for today, I thought that Lamentations, the third chapter, where the author is talking about he's lamenting some of the terrible things that has happened in his life, and how this affliction is with him all the time. And then he comes to this thought. The thought of my affliction is with me always. My soul continually thinks of it and is bowed down within me. But this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. The steadfast love of God never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore, I will hope in him. The Lord is good to those who wait for him, to the soul that seeks him. It is good that one should wait quietly for the salvation of our God. There is a wonderful privilege that we have in these moments to wait silently for the blessing that God brings to each of us. Probably each of us, I want to say that I think every one of us is spiritual dimension, whatever we want to call our own personal spirituality, is as unique to us as our fingerprints. No one of us is exactly alike, and no one of us experiences God exactly alike. So I want to invite us to have just a moment of silence, that you may express your sentiment and your feeling in these times of silence, in prayer, in reflection, in memory, in meditation. Let us be silent. Amen. I understand that Jeff was not a religious man, and yet he was a spiritual man. And when the family said that to me, it reminded me of an incident when Karl Barth, a great theologian, a German theologian, was giving a lecture, and at the end of the lecture he was receiving questions. And someone asked him, "To what religion, or to what faith, has God most sincerely and ultimately revealed God's self?" And he stepped away from the pulpit and addressed the question. And he said, "God does not reveal God's self to any institution. God reveals God's self to individuals." And therefore, I think that we each have this God-given capacity for spirituality, for our own sense of God's presence with us, by our own experience of that intimacy. As we come to this time of sharing our memories, I'm very pleased that members of the family and friends are going to do that, and I invite Aaron and Adam to come and share with us first.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for coming today. We really appreciate it. It's my sister Erin, and she wrote something that she wanted to speak, but we've decided that we're going to both try to say it together and trade off a little bit. Can you hold this up? A tattered black and white photo on my mantle shows a handsome young athlete. It is my father, dressed smartly in blue and white pinstripe uniform of a Big Ten varsity baseball team. Having just pitched a nasty fastball, his body is releasing in a way that pitchers' bodies do. His eyes are trained on the ball, anticipating the response and preparing for action. Another photo taken not more than a year later shows the same handsome man, shirtless, tanned, a series of colored pastels surrounding him on the pavement of a street in France, where he is sketching for money. The ground around him is littered with French coins.
One of my favorite photos shows a man in his 30s, still athletic, still tanned, on a private beach. He's got a goatee and one of those hip, colorful, loose-fitting shirts that dreamers wore in the 70s, and he's surrounded by a dozen playful, cheering children, including his own. He's just caught a huge striped bass, and he is absolutely beaming. An athlete, an artist, a parent, and a friend. My father has continually amazed me. He was the hero who bicycled up the big hill in Central Park, his outstretched hand pulling not one, but two children on bicycles up the hill behind him. He was the father who picked the most elaborately beautiful cards, birthday cards, Valentine's, Easter, drawing perfect hearts and wishes on the inside. He was the one who introduced me to literature, surf casting, theater, Manhattan, the arts, and spirituality.
Those of you who knew Dad well have your own private recollections, memories of the times you shared with him, dreaming about architecture or playing golf, exploring Buddhism, quantum healing, Zen in the art of motorcycle maintenance, or the Kabbalah of a layman. Maybe you fished with him or competed ferociously on the handball courts at the Y. Maybe you ate together at Jackson Hole, the Peking Duck, or Nadine's, or any of his other favorite city haunts. Maybe you ran from arrows launched by a laughing madman. Perhaps you feared when he played with the knife in front of you that he magically pulled from some hidden location in his home amongst with all of his other stash of knives. Or when he launched fireworks from his apartment window in your direction as you left his home. When someone dies, you spend a lot of time poring through their things, photos, books, notes, computer files. As I looked through the things my father left behind, I found a few that I thought were worth sharing as we remember him today. Some of you will know that my father was a voracious reader. He was historic for taking a book and boogering it up thoroughly, underlining favorite passages, scribbling designs in the margins, turning down pages, and breaking the spine. Sadly, he ruined my entire comic book collection in the same way.
Some of these were funny, like this one from Zen Judaism that he marked especially for me, a gentle admonishment for losing his favorite black leather jacket in a bar on the Upper East Side. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. Just minutes ago, you had a hat. Now it's gone, fleeting like a puff of smoke. Your hat was merely part of an endlessly moving stream, a great river of transient phenomena rising and falling, coming to be and passing away. Same with your missing gloves. And no, they are not behind the couch. Everything is impermanent, even the theory of impermanence. This is why it is so important to stay on top of things.
Others were poignant, like the passage from Emerson tucked into Awakening the Buddha Within. To laugh often and much, to win the respect of intelligent people and the affection of children, to earn the appreciation of honest critics and endure the betrayal of false friends, to appreciate beauty, to find the best in others, to leave the world a bit better, whether by a healthy child, a garden, or a redeemed social condition, to know even one's life has breathed easier because you have lived. This is to have succeeded. I hope you'll agree that my father did succeed in these things. He took pleasure in life. He shared his humor broadly. He was respected for his intelligence. He was humbled by a lasting awe of beauty. And he maintained an enduring appreciation for each of the members of my family and his lifelong friends. Many of you are here today.
In trying to explain to his grandson that my father was dead, I came across a book written for children titled Badger's Parting Gift. A description of the dream that Badger has the evening he dies was so soothing to me. It seemed in keeping with my father's personal beliefs about death that I thought it would be worthwhile to read. Here it is. Much to Badger's surprise, he was running. Ahead of him was a very long tunnel. His legs felt strong and sure as he ran toward it. He no longer needed his walking stick, so he left it lying on the floor of the tunnel. Badger moved swiftly, running faster and faster through the long passageway until his paws no longer touched the earth. He felt himself turning end over end, tumbling and falling, but nothing hurt. He felt free. It was as if he had fallen out of his body.
From the time of my father's stroke 3.5 years ago to his recent diagnosis with pancreatic cancer, he fought hard for his life. He struggled for balance on joints weakened by a lifetime of sports. He was easily fatigued. On Sunday night, June 1st, at 10:15 p.m., like Badger, he left his walking canes behind, and I would bet that he is with us today, touched by our ceremony, distressed by our sadness, and fully at peace.
I wanted to read something my father marked this passage in Conversations with God, which Carmen bought for him and was one of his favorite books. But I could never quite understand why myself. Now maybe I do. Understand that death is not an end, but a beginning, not a horror, but a joy. It is not a closing down, but an opening up. The happiest moment of your life will be the moment it ends. That's because it doesn't end, but only goes on in ways so magnificent, so full of peace and wisdom and joy, as to make it difficult to describe and impossible for you to comprehend.
Thank you.
A longtime friend is Brooke Hart.
Well, good afternoon to all of you who have come to share the memory of our dear friend. Your son, your father, your brother, and a man who played a really important role in many of our lives. Because in the end, what we have are memories. Just think for a moment how it would be if your memory is wiped out, what it means to really have amnesia. Your life is contoured with those memories, and they give substance to your everyday existence. And so I can recall 50 years, almost to the day, of memories of Jeff Spanier. And I recall a generous and kind and adventurous and intelligent, a warm and caring person who had a side of him that was characterized by some fomenting anger and attitude and excitement that sometimes resulted, although fortunately never seriously, in injury or risk of some catastrophe. We start in our earliest years in junior high school at Great Neck High School in the backyard of this gentleman over here, Eddie Golden. He sponsored an afternoon basketball activity that many of us attended, many of us in this room, Dubin and Ackerman, Golden, Bloom was there, Wolosoff. We would gather in the afternoons after school because it wasn't yet time to compete on the playing field, we were too young, and pretend we were Karl Braun or Max Zaslavsky, or I guess some of us even pretended we were Sweetwater Clifton. And we played, and we played together, and we began associations and friendships. Lauber was there. Arlo was there, although he was probably out learning some nuclear physics for a little later. These friendships began then. Sussman was there. These friendships lasted Jeff's lifetime. And they sustained him, and they sustained us. Goldman was there. Bell Gluskin and others who are here today, Tony Pasciota. They weren't allowed to play, but we couldn't wait to get done with the game so we could go and play with them. And from that, a kind of a core, a nucleus, Slayton and Merlini and Bloom and the rest of us competed together on the high school teams, first in the ninth grade. Jeff began to grow and grow and grow, and he just kept growing. And then in the summer of 1956, Jeff and Steve Goldmark, who later was married to Tony, and I went to Bucks Rock Work Camp in New Milford, Connecticut. And we had a wonderful summer there. Of course, Jeff was growing. And one of the things he liked to do, and Dubin will remember this, and so will Arlo, was he was really into the impedimenta of making small holes with his bow and arrow. With the knives that Adam referred to, Jeff had butterfly knives, he had switchblade knives, he had large knives, and he never gave up these knives. In fact, fast forwarding ahead to last year, or the year before, I had had a bicycle accident and I had injured my hip and it was deteriorating. And so I had to walk around dragging my left leg while I contemplated whether I should put a steel joint in there. And so I got to New York and I was using one of these, you know, Terrace Chemists or Walgreens canes. I mean, it wasn't very fancy. And Jeff said, well, come right in here. Let me show you my selection of canes. And he gave me a beautiful wooden cane, which I used until, fortunately, after I put the new joint in, I now hang in a place of honor in my home in Hawaii. But what kind of a cane did he have? You open it up and there it is! A blade that could pierce a motor car. Now, fortunately, Jeff did not use these items in a way that generally hurt others. Those explosions that he would set off when you left his home would be in your honor, and usually nobody got injured. There was an exception. At one point, he fired off an arrow and hit Arlo in the leg. Arlo's still with us. At the reunion in 1999, Arlo was heard to say in the parking lot, Jeff, don't worry about it. It was only a flesh wound. So it was a side of Jeff. I mean, I was, you know, I might have had a paring knife. I got one of my wives gave me a nice knife. We got on the way to, well, we got in Alaska. Of course, as soon as the 9/11 came, I had to put all the knives in a drawer because you couldn't use the knives anymore for anything. But that was a side of Jeff that was part of his adventurous side. And there were many things that went with that, that some of us experienced right along with him. And fortunately, Jeff took it to a point where it was just short. Well, maybe on one occasion it wasn't short, but usually no one was arrested and no one was seriously injured. Now, as we grew up in Great Neck and as we had the opportunity to play ball together, Jeff developed into an excellent baseball player, a fine swimmer, and aside from being, the New York State Junior Archery Champion at some point, one of the best of us. He was favored in baseball by at least two things. First, he inherited wonderful baseball genes from this man right here. Irv could throw that thing. I mean, I remember him when Irv was about 50 or so, and he was in the backyard on Wildwood firing that ball. And he could show you how to throw a curveball, and Jeff was blessed with some kind of a deformity in his finger that allowed him to grip the ball in a way that he could fire a knuckleball that would go past the batter. And even Tucker, who hit about 438 in his, senior or junior year, right? Even Tucker had some difficulty hitting that. Now, there was another side to Jeff, and it was that at least I, and he called me Z. I don't know whether Tucker remembers this. One day in 1958, we were playing baseball. It was Great Neck against some other school. And David's father attended the game, the great Richard Tucker. And of course, Richard, who was a great Metropolitan Opera star, was charged with conserving his voice so he would never talk when he didn't have to. And so we're standing near the bench, and Reuben was standing on the bench itself, because he wasn't as tall as some others, wanted to see in the outfield. And David walked by, and Reuben said to him, David, telling Dave that he better go home and shave. So after that, Spanier and I started to call David Z, and he started to call us Z, and David and Jeff called me Z, and for about 46 years, Jeff and I rarely refer to each other as anything but Z. It's one of those things you take with you. It's just an aspect of it that brings us closer together. Now, when we lived at Buck's Rock that summer in 1956, and Jeff was growing so much, we lived in an aluminum house. It was actually all made of aluminum. And of course, this was a God-given target for Jeff with those arrows. He would stand 40 or 50 yards down the campus of the camp, and when I would approach, or Goldmark would approach, or we had another roommate, now Dr. Lawrence Cohn of Scarsdale, New York, Laurie Cohn, and Jeff would fire off these arrows, never hitting any of us. But by the end of the summer, the building was leaking. And of course, Jeff also took great pride, as he got taller, in being able to aim into these little holes, one of which was right above my head on the bunk below Jeff, whatever he might have that would be of liquid concoction. And then we got him one day when he was sleeping on that top bed in the afternoon. He'd take a nap because he was growing so fast he really needed to take a rest once in a while. His body was just outstripping him. But he would fall asleep and his long arm would fall into the middle of the cabin. And because this was a small cabin, that arm would be in the way. And we thought it was just the biggest trick when we got a big can of shaving cream, filled his hand with it, and then took a feather and tickled his nose, and he just nearly suffocated himself. You know, in those days, the pranks were pretty harmless, right? Things have changed. Well, into the 60s, we went, we all went off to college. And there was a period of time when we didn't have, or I didn't have as much contact with him, and he was at Penn State and I was at Johns Hopkins, and then I guess he was in Florida for a while or somewhere, but I went off to Hawaii. And so for a little while we talked on the phone from time to time, our friendship rekindled in the late 60s when, after settling in Hawaii, I began to come back to New York, and in the early 70s. And by then, Adam and Aaron were just little children, and Jeff had gone through the first difficulty of a number of difficulties with women with whom he had difficulty, and he was handling that difficulty as best he could. And we picked up kind of where we left off in the early 70s. Jeff had this apartment at 91st Street, I guess, right off of Lexington, kind of the home base for all the trouble that we would get into over the next, well, until Paula came. But until Paula, where I would usually come on the numerous trips I would take from Hawaii to this city of our birth. And Jeff had at Buck's Rock, had his first introduction to building. One of the things at that work camp was the construction crew. And we actually built a large and complex building, a new wood shop for the camp. If you go to New Milford, Connecticut, and you go to the camp, you'll see on the cornerstone, the glazed cornerstone, among other names, Jeffrey P. Spanier. And that's where he kind of got, if not his first interest, among the first major influences on what he wanted to be when he grew up in terms of a profession. And he took to building things. He knew how to point up with a trowel. He knew how to lay block and brick. He took an interest in the actual building of the building and seemed enthused by that. Goldmark did too, and they both became architects. And it was from that experience that he had pursued the profession of architecture, a difficult profession, one in which there are many disappointments. And Jeffrey excelled as an architect. Technically, he made beautiful things. In 1980, when I rebuilt my law office from scratch, Jeff came out to Hawaii to review the plans. And he came in and he said, you know, he says, there's one thing missing here. He says, it's right up there on the wall. I want you to put a backwash light. And every day when I go into the office and I turn the light on, that's the Jeff Spanier light. And that light, although not an integral part of the structure itself, made the environment. It made it right. And that was a characteristic of Jeff. It was an aspect of Jeff. Jeff had an artistic sense. You know, Adam was talking about he chose the right cards. He understood what it meant to communicate in a very personal way. And he cared about you as a friend in a way that all of us have experienced as a special part of our lives. Now, there was one day when Jeff's other side of him kind of took over. I remember at Bucks Rock, and the camp was hit by a bit of a flu. And so many of the campers were making many trips to the restroom. And on Fridays was laundry day, and everybody had to pack up all the laundry and carry it in 100-pound bags down a hill. And Jeff took some great interest in coming up behind you and catching you with his shoe so that if you were carrying that bag, you, the bag, and whatever else might be ailing you would also go down the hill. It was just the way he was. Never vicious, but often violent, but never damaging. He had the greatest degree of commitment to his friends and his family. When Erin ran into trouble with her life, Jeff was vigilant. Jeff did everything he could to make sure that the man who was not nice to Erin was out of the way, was being dealt with, was being pursued so that he would not do further damage to Erin and her child. And Jeff carried that battle right up to just a few weeks ago. He would talk frequently about meeting with some guys from New Jersey to deal with a problem in that manner, and I would, as his attorney from afar, Dubin was on site, but I was on the phone, advise him to relax because he wasn't going to deal with the problem that way. But he thought about it a lot. Let me say that. In the 1970s, Jeff befriended a number of our children because many of us, I guess it was popular. I don't know, maybe we wouldn't do it if we had to do it again. But as I look around, few of us here can say that we only married once. Which might be a nice thing to be able to say, but unfortunately, among our group, we kind of had a lot of wives. And I've had at least three myself. And so there are children. And children of divorce need support, and they need love, and they need help. And Jeffrey was one guy who gave that love. He gave that support. Nasser's nodding over there, he knows. And he gave out to Golden's children and was known as Big Seth to Mark and Simona, right? And to my Morgan and Lauren, he was a kind of source of strength, helping them to deal with an aspect of their lives that wasn't pleasant. And Jeff could do this in a way that was almost unique. Few people could. He loved Adam and Erin so much, and he cared so much for their welfare. And his first goal was always to make sure that your lives were as best as they could be. He and Adam, I mean, I look at Adam now. This picture of Jeff is our, this is our yearbook picture. And Jeff matured so much, he so much character came after this. I look at Adam, I see a slightly sleeker model, but all the characteristics in the face. This picture, I think, of Jeff as Adonis. This one, I think, it looks like it was taken outside of, what, Kathy Klein's pool? Could that be? Golden is our resident historian. He would know. But Jeff grew into a marvelously strong fellow who was strong not only in body, but strong in character. Now, as the 80s approached, I can recall in the early 80s, 1980, I remarried and I came with my second wife, Barbara, to New York. We were going on our way to Newport for a honeymoon. And we saw absolutely no reason why Jeff should not accompany us on the honeymoon. And he did. The idea is he'd meet somebody along the way. And he did. I remember it like it was yesterday. Here we were in a really nice beachside cabin in Newport, Rhode Island, on the actual beach. And we had stopped at an antique store earlier that day and bought some beautiful lamps and a huge Mexican sombrero. And Barbara and I were in the room, and Jeff was there, and he was wearing these striped jockey briefs that he liked to wear, and the sombrero. And then suddenly, he was gone. And Barbara and I looked around, we looked outside, and way down the beach, there was Jeff, still wearing those briefs and the sombrero, engaged with some strange woman that he had spied from far away and run off to befriend, which he did. And I think she was kind of in residence on the trip for a while after that. During that trip, we stopped in Nantucket to talk about that fishing. One morning, it was about 5:30 in the morning, and I was sleeping there, here with my kind of new wife, although I'd been with her for 8 years. And suddenly I felt this wet on my face. And what can I woke up, and there is Jeff with what must have been a 30-pound huge sea bass shaking it over us. He had gone out at 4 in the morning and caught 2 huge sea bass. And every day as I sit at my desk in my office in Hawaii and I turn around and look at my corkboard, which has pictures of all of us for 40 years, or more, there's Jeff standing there with this giant smile, holding these 2 enormous sea bass that he caught. He was a great fisherman. In addition to knifing things, he caught them as well. Now, during the 70s and the 80s, Jeff had a number of liaisons, a number of wives, a number of women. When we'd come to New York, there'd usually be a new one in residence. He was seeking the right one. And similar to many of us, this was a challenge for Jeff. And it wasn't till about, 1995 or so, that this sane, sensible, lovely, cultured, friendly, and loving woman, Paula Mictum, came into his life. And what a change! What a change! Well, you know, okay, maybe we miss the excesses of the 70s and 80s, and even the early 90s. But we don't miss them that much, because it's so nice to see. It was so good to experience Jeff finally getting centered, getting focused, putting aside some of the more destructive aspects of his youth, and really growing up in a kind of all of a sudden. And it isn't to say that he was some sophomoric, immature guy. It's just to say that All that wildness was finally tamed by this beautiful woman who made, I think, a wonderful contribution to Jeff's life. And Paula herself, having had some real difficulty in her own life, can only reflect on what it means to be a person who at least two major men have chosen to spend their last days with. Because somewhere in the unconscious, that decision had to be known. And Jeff made the right decision. And his life came together in a way that was positive for him. And things were going pretty damn well until that day when I was just come off the ski slope in Aspen and I get a call from Adam that Jeff has had this little blood clot that traveled around after ankle surgery. And we immediately hoped and prayed that it would be okay. And Jeff, who lost a lot of his ability to work with numbers and even most of his speech, rallied, worked on it, struggled, did everything he could to put himself back in a place where he could continue to work and continue to function as a proud man that he was. And he did pretty damn well. Even with those injuries he had from all the sports, and as he and I would frequently remark to each other, probably carrying a little more weight than we should be, he was strong as an ox. And so in February of last year, just before I went to replace my hip, I came here with Joanne, the woman I've been with for 12 years, and Jeff had welcomed her in 1992 or one at a party at his home, as he welcomed all of my wives and all of the women. But he welcomed her, and she, like Paula, survived all of this and became very close with Jeff. And when she contemplated, because she knew that we would lose Jeff soon, she said, I'm coming with you when you go to see him. And so 3 weeks ago, Joanne and I came so we could spend some time with Jeff and Paula. And we'd planned to go to the theater two nights and just spend a good part of the week together. Unfortunately, Jeff couldn't go to the two plays. He was on the phone after the play was over while we were at dinner with Paula. But we did have a wonderful evening with Jeff and Adam and Joe Butler, who isn't here today, but Yancey is. And so we got to say our goodbyes. Now, my experience is that, you know, it's not really goodbye, and I'll tell you why I think it's not. In about 1975 or six, some guy invited me over to his house for lunch, and he spiked some tea with something that to this day I don't know what was in there. But on the way back to the office, I suddenly went into some kind of a serious disarray. And so Barbara took me to the emergency room where, as you can see, they managed to revive me. But at that point, I had this experience. And it was that I was going down a long tunnel. And at the end of the tunnel, there was a white light. And I went into that white light, and there, behind his desk in our home in the den in Great Neck, was my father, who had died 3 years earlier. And he looked up at me, and he said, "It's not time yet. Go back." And so I lived. But that gave me the notion that there is something more. That when they're talking or people talk about passing over, there is a passing over. And so I fully expect to see this guy if I'm fortunate enough to go to the same place where he'll be welcomed. And I also imagine that having learned our lessons, we probably won't engage in the degrees of excess that we did for so many years. Well, I guess it's traditional when a warrior passes to have a 21-gun salute. In Jeff's case, I don't really, I mean, there probably were, but I don't recall any guns. So what we should have is a 21-arrow salute for Jeff. And we should just have a minute, 30 seconds, to just think for a second or two, a few, of our own best memories of our dear friend and brother and son and husband and father and father-in-law. Because Jeffrey Spanier touched us all, and he made, in some way or other, all of our lives better. Thank you very much.
Daughter, and Joe was very, very dear friends with Jeff. And looking at this picture now, my father also went to Great Neck High, and that picture without my glasses looked exactly like my father. Same hair, same tie, same glance out to the side, and it made me kind of giggle. I don't even know where to begin. My father sends his deepest condolences and his regret for not being able to be here today, but he is here in spirit. And I'll never forget the first time I heard about Jeff. And I believe that Aaron and Adam spoke of one of the things that he had underlined in one of his passages about winning the affections of children. My father is a 61-year-old, 5-year-old. And that is what Jeff was able to bring out in him. He spoke of going to a reunion and meeting this great new friend and this great new friend, and you have to meet him and you have to meet him, and to the point of Jeff. And he never stopped talking about, I'm going to go see my friend Jeff. Well, do you want to get together for breakfast? No, you're welcome to come with us, but I'm going to see my friend Jeff. And this was all the time. And he brought out the giggliest of my father, and they made quite a good match. He certainly won the affection of that child, who is my father. When I finally did meet Jeff, it was as if I'd known him my entire life. I was so awash with peacefulness and spirituality and a grace and a zest for life that is unprecedented in any human being I've ever met in my life, and a sense of humor, which is important in all of our daily matters. My father wrote a poem as soon as he did receive the news, and he would like me to share it here and with Jeff. To Jeff with love. Around the corner and down the street, there's a friend I used to meet. We'd sit and laugh and talk and eat, then slowly walk our village streets. And now he's moved to a new neighborhood. It may be better, but it's not so good to sit or walk alone or miss him when I pick up the phone and he doesn't say, "You hungry, pal?" So now I must wait until I move and hope it will be nearby, so I can again see his face and we can find another place, and I will have my friend to meet around the corner and down the street. Your pal, Joe. I know that my father has never been more grateful for Jeff's presence in his life, and for the presence of you, Paula. I remember my father, one of the many times that I saw him cry in the past couple of days, and when he couldn't be here because of business, he was beside himself. He said the one thing that Jeff always wanted was a companion to play golf with, and I just don't golf. And he broke out in tears, and at which point I was able to say to him, "Dad, he just wanted you to be a companion." My father was very lucky, and as you spoke of, Jeff will be visited, and my father can't wait to see him as well. Thank you very much for letting me share this.
Well, hasn't this been beautiful? It's wonderful to hear you laugh and also to hear you cry and to realize that both belong in the same place, that our memories are so complex and so wonderful, so many different varieties. You are particularly blessed because, you know, when someone passes and they've had a little time to be with you and to say goodbye, how wonderful that has been for you. And Brooke, I think that anyone has had the experience that you have. I began this afternoon by saying that I hope that you don't have fear. No one has had the experience of near-death experience that Brooke explained to us ever has fear of death. So we come as people of spiritual quality that have no need for fear. And Jeff had marked some things in a book that Aaron gave to me that invited me to read for you. It is so easy to waste our lives, our days, our hours, our minutes. It is so easy to take for granted the pale new growth on the evergreen, the sheen of the limestone on Fifth Avenue, the color of our kids' eyes, the way the melody of a symphony rises and falls and disappears and rises again. It is so easy to exist instead of live. Look at the lilies of the field. Look at the fuzz on the baby's ear. Read in the backyard with the sun on your face. Learn to be happy. Think of life as a terminal illness, because if you do, you will live it with joy and passion as it ought to be lived. Anyone can learn all those things out there in the world. You just need to get a life, a real life, a full life, a professional life, yes, but another life. The one that school never ends. The classroom is everywhere. The exam comes at the very end. No man ever said on his deathbed, "I wish I had spent more time at the office." Well, haven't we learned some beautiful lessons today? I hope that the memories that you have shared verbally and that you have thought in your mind will be one of the ways in which Jeff will experience mortality, immortality. And yet there's another bigger way, because we do believe that God has provided for us far beyond what we can see or comprehend. So we are now about ready to make an eternal covenant with God for the eternal care of Jeffrey Spanner. That as he has borne the image of an earthly man, a physical, athletic, energetic man who is also sensitive and artistic, that now that man also bears the image of the spiritual. That he has taken on a new image that we don't know much about yet, but hopefully we will. Will you join me in prayer? Almighty God, give us now your grace that as we shrink before the mystery of death, we may indeed see the light of eternity. Speak to us once more your solemn message of life and of death. Help us to live as those who are prepared to die, and when our days here are accomplished, enable us to die as those who go forth to live, so that living or dying, our life may be in you, and that nothing in life or death will be able to separate us from the love and the memory of those who have gone before us. And now, most gracious God, we make this eternal covenant with you for the eternal care of Jeff, and ask your special blessing upon all his family and his friends, those present here and those who are thinking of us today. Grant your blessing as we acknowledge our total dependence upon you. And now may the blessing of God be with each of us, now and forever. Amen.